Support for this podcast comes from Frito-Lay and the 2023 Snack Bracket Championship. The Frito-Lay Snacker Challenge is underway, and fans are voting on their favorite snacks to crown champion. We're talking about primetime matchups between the best 64 snacks in the land. Will Ruffles Ridges reign supreme? Can Doritos defend their dynasty? Or will Smart Food use their smarts for a surprise upset? Only you can decide. Get in on all the action for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks. Let your snacks be heard. Just go to FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com to vote and enter for a chance to win. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends April 3rd, 2023. Void where prohibited. Year's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at FritoLaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
Jordan is on best. Harper's on Miller.
Play together, they believe. And Karis LeVert is cold.
LeVert back in. Speed. Oh, he's a one-man wrecking crew.
Holiday. Shot clock down to six. Finds Warren. Here's a long three.
Welcome to another edition of the Indy Corn Rose Podcast. This is your host, Mark Schindler. As always, before we get started today, if you have not already, please be sure to rate and review us over on Apple Podcasts. We always want to hear from you and get your feedback. You're why we do this, so it's always great to get your opinions, understand where you're coming from. I'm always here to answer any questions, take any comments, always down to talk some basketball. And of course, read us over at IndyCornrows.com. Now that the off season is starting to wrap up, somehow it's the first day of September today, which is just still wild to say. Simultaneously the longest and shortest summer of my life. Just got back from Toronto yesterday. After a week off to go spend some time up there, getting back and getting ready for a new season starting up. So it's kind of wild, but it's almost here is my point. The first game of the season for the Pacers is on October 20th, which is in less than 50 days now, I believe. If I'm doing it correctly in my head, yeah, it's less than 50 days. I think that's like exactly 48 days. I'm not great with the dates. I don't have the calendar right in front of me. But point being, close enough. Training camp is going to start up. We're getting there. First things first today, Keelan Martin's guaranteed date got pushed back again, as reported by Scott Agnes over at Fieldhouse Files. This makes sense for both parties. Keelan obviously wanting to stick in the NBA, show what he can do so that he can maintain a playing career and get as much money as he can. From a team moving forward, and also for the Pacers, they aren't really sure what they want to do with the last roster spot. So I guess it makes sense in that sense. Maybe you want to see what it looks, how does Kiefer Sykes look in camp? How does Dejan Giroux look in camp, even though he already got a two-way? There are a lot of ways that they could look at things. I really think, I don't want to say it's inconsequential. It's not. It's always worth looking and seeing how these things could play out. But it's still interesting that it's been pushed back this many times and this far. It's not fully guaranteed until the first day of the season on the 19th. So this gives the Pacers the entire remaining of the offseason up through preseason to find out what they're going to do with Keelan's roster spot. We'll obviously be keeping up to date on that. But for today, you guys were kind enough to send in some mailbag questions. Obviously, again, it's kind of more of a dead period right now. There's a lot going on. So I wanted to answer your questions, see where you're at, and give you my thoughts on it as well. So first question is from Zach Barnett at ZBarnettNBA on Twitter. What's your dream trade scenario to put this team at the top of the East? What's a realistic trade that would make the biggest shakeup in a good way? So I was actually talking about this with Ricky O'Donnell from over at the main site on SB Nation, covering the NBA. On what a Ben Simmons trade would look like. And I don't know when that piece is going to be up because I have a small blurb that'll go into it. But basically, I'm going to just kind of give my thoughts on that really quick. Because in all honesty, I think that is the most realistic right now. I don't think the Pacers are going to be in play for Damian Lillard if he ever does become available. In terms of looking at other guys around the NBA, I mean, other than Ben Simmons, there just is not anybody who is on the market right now. That is a quote-unquote star or superstar. Again, I still don't even think that I want to preface by saying I don't think this is a very likely trade to happen just based on how things have gone. The Pacers have talked with the Sixers you know, based on reporting, I believe the original deal was Malcolm and two firsts or a first. I don't remember off the top of my head, but that was Jay Michael who reported that. It was either Jay Michael or Michael Scotto from Hoopsite. I can't remember off the top of my head right now. But point being, the Pacers have been in on that conversation, so it's not entirely implausible, but it also just seems unlikely. But in talking with Ricky, this is what came up. It was a TJ Warren and Malcolm swap for Ben Simmons straight up. That works pretty much perfectly money-wise. And so here, just my quick thoughts on it right away. It's really tough because, A, I mean, just looking at it as an analyst overall, I love what that does for Philadelphia. I think that solves some of their problems, even though it's not perfect. I mean, TJ's fantastic. He brings you somebody who still gives defense on the wing. Malcolm obviously plays defense at a quality level as well, while also becoming the best driver on that offense, probably the best playmaker on that offense in the half court. Or not probably, definitely the best playmaker in the offense on that offense in the half court. It solves things for them. Also, Ben Simmons is the most talented player in that deal, the youngest, and on a long-term contract, all things that would behoove the Pacers' brain trust to make this trade. I normally am about talent over everything, but the fit is just really wonky when looking at the idea of a Sabonis-Turner-Simmons front court. I think this is something that you look at if there's a subsequent deal with one of the bigs to bring in more perimeter talent. I think that makes sense, but the team can already struggle in half-court or late shot clock situations, as we know. On top of that, Brogdon and Warren are both sub-all-star, borderline all-star talents who the Pacers have no real replacement for. So again, it's wonky. Definitely worth thinking about. As dynamic and good of a player as Ben Simmons is, he is not an elite driver of offense in the half court. I mean, I think he's right around 11 drives per 75. Malcolm's around 15. Malcolm is considered an elite driver. Ben is like an above average driver, but you know, especially when you factor in physical gifts and size and everything in tandem, there's definitely a drop off there. The rim finishing is obviously a different story between him and Malcolm, but also Malcolm, like a lot of Malcolm's finishes are going to be unassisted at the rim. A lot of Ben's are not. That's a big difference. You need somebody who can get to the rim in an unassisted fashion because that opens everything else up. It's less about finishing at the rim, more about the ability to tilt the defense. So it's just a different thing to look on. So you're banking a lot on the idea of Ben and or Caris LeVert getting better at getting to the cup with more consistency, which is something you could bank on, but again, wonkiness. Simmons and Sabonis also operate from very similar spaces as higher mid-post playmakers, using their height and court vision to pick apart a defense. What does that look like with two players who aren't being respected past the free throw line? Playmaking is probably the most important offensive skill in the league. You can never have enough, but the fit is certainly odd. I would ultimately be in on this for Indiana, but admit that the team would probably not feel similarly. They view themselves as a win-now team, as we've talked about. And I think it would require a one step back, two steps forward approach, trying to restructure a younger team around Simmons after trading two of the three best perimeter options in the organization, while knowing more moves are happening in conjunction here. If I could, I would counter with something involving the same players, but adding in Tyrese Maxey and a conglomeration of Pacers picks to make that trade worthwhile for the Sixers. Maxey would provide another building block towards a younger team with a brighter future, and the Sixers would acquire more draft capital for subsequent moves to tweak their roster. It's not perfect, and I wouldn't want to part with Maxey if I'm Daryl Morey, but I would certainly try and make it happen if I'm Indiana. I think, you know, something that I don't write about in there is talking about, like, with TJ, a lot of it is, like, you factor in, okay, he's an expiring contract. I am of the camp that the Pacers should do everything in their power to re-sign TJ Warren. I think by all accounts, that's what they're aiming to do. But again, I think just in looking at this trade in a microcosmic view, I think it does make sense in some ways. I'm not entirely sure that the Sixers would feel the same way. They've been pretty, especially looking back at the James Harden trade, they did not want to give up a Tyrese Maxey, and that was a selling point for them. Tyrese Maxey is going to be incredibly good. Like, I think he's going to be a starting point guard, starting guard, however you want to cut it, in the NBA, and that means something. So if you were able to get him back, I think that solves some more of the questions you have. Getting back Simmons is a premier talent overall, regardless of how people feel about him right now. He's not on a bad contract. He's getting paid appropriately for the kind of player he is. I understand having real concerns about him, but also, where are you getting that player if you're Indiana, I don't really think that there is another way to get a player of that level, given how they have approached the draft for the most part. I don't know. I think there's a lot to think about there. Again, it's not cut and dry, perfect. I think I would heavily consider it, but it all just kind of depends how you're looking at it. And in terms of talking about the one step back, two forward approach, you're trading two of the older core players to get a 25-year-old three-time All-Star on a full long-term deal. Both those guys are up for, TJ is up for extension already. His deal expires this year. Malcolm has 2 years left, including this year. So in some ways, you're losing a little bit of roster talent to try and improve your top-end talent, and factoring in that you're going to be more viable long-term potentially. So again, not perfect, but that's just kind of where I was coming from on that. I appreciate the question, Zach. I know that was a longer response, but I also wanted to hit on some of the Ben stuff because I've hit a lot of it on Twitter. We've hit it in previous pods, me and Caitlin have, but that's just adding some more on top. So thank you for the question. On to Alex Golden. Where do you see the Pacers finishing in the Eastern Conference? Are you in favor of entering the season with a 14-man roster or keeping it at 15 with keeping Keelan Martin or possibly signing Sykes to a minimum deal? So number one, where do you see the Pacers finishing in the Eastern Conference is a very tough question. I think I'll give a range. Like, I think they could finish as high as fourth if things really go well this year, which is entirely feasible. Let's say they have good health. They really gel together. They gel with the coaching staff. Rick Carlisle is able to really make everything click, and they have some internal improvement. Like, I think that the third or fourth seed is not entirely unattainable, while also acknowledging, like, some crazy shit has to happen on the side. Like maybe the Hawks have injuries, which you never want to wish on somebody, but that stuff does happen every year. Maybe the Bucks take a step back, which I doubt. Maybe things don't go great with Philly, which is actually entirely possible. So I think you can factor that in just looking at it in terms of this year finishing in the regular season standings. Third is attainable, but I also think if injuries do happen, if things don't break right, it's entirely possible this team is a play-in team again. Like, that would not surprise me. I think you look at this Eastern Conference, and it is the deepest the Eastern Conference has been in my time really being invested in the NBA. And honestly, just I'd say since the early 2000s, it has to be close to that. There are 11 or 12 teams that are all capable and trying to make the playoffs next year. So, I think that's how I look at it. Just to give a final recap, my range would be like 3.5 to 9.5. I think is entirely feasible that they fall anywhere in between there. As for the second part of the question, I personally would be fine with leaving the roster spot open, but I think I'll go towards more keeping it at 15 while keeping Keelan Martin, because I always want somebody to get paid and I always feel bad about the idea of somebody getting cut. I do think that Keelan showed some stuff down the stretch last year that was enough to say he's worth keeping as deep bench rotation guy this year. Like, especially over the last 10 or 15 games, he looked good. The shot was there for him. I thought his defense was better. Obviously, he had that game against Brooklyn where he played some decent defense on Kevin Durant, which is not everything, but, you know, there was something there. I also would not be opposed to giving Kiefer Sykes a minimum deal. I do think you could squint and say, okay, well, the Pacers need to have a third point guard, but if they theoretically view Dejan Giroux as a backup point guard or just as a point guard in general, then why wouldn't you just call him up from a two-way spot to come up and play if he's needed? So I guess it just kind of depends how you're looking at it. There are a lot of variations that they could go, but I also think I can't really fault any of them is how I would look at it. So thanks for the question, Alex. This question from Tony East is going to explode my brain because I've thought about it quite a bit. Would you rather have a player who shoots 5 of 5 in 40% of their games and 0 of 5 in 60% of their games, or a player who shoots exactly 2 out of 5 every single game? Okay, so I'm going to pretend this is from 3 because I think that's the question. So here's the thing. All right, so I think some people might say 5 out of 5 in 40% of their games. And 05 and 60, because that way you know, okay, well, if you get 15 guaranteed points from this guy in 40% of the games, how can you lose? Or something like that, like along those lines. I think I would look at it more in terms of, and I know you told me not to be logical with this, Tony. I don't care. You know me. I'm being logical. I would rather have a player who shoots 2 out of 5 every game, a crisp 40%, because that's something, I mean, you can't really bank on that happening, but like, in terms of looking at it, like, you just kind of know, like, you're getting that guaranteed 6 points every night, and I think that that makes a big difference, and ultimately, like, it all plays out the same numerically, for, in terms of, like, totals, but also, I think having that 6 point boost every single night instead of a 15 point boost 40% of the nights, and then no boost on 60% of them, maybe I'm thinking about this too much, but I think I would rather have the consistency is how I would look at it. And if we've learned anything from variance in three-point shooting, as Doug McDermott has shown us, it's better to have somebody who is consistent all the way across the board, not to slander Doug. But yes, that's how I would lean on it. Thank you for the question. Hopefully I answered it appropriately. From my guy Rich over at Mavs Draft, not sure how much Mavs you watch, but what's your general expectations of Carlisle and what he'll translate from Dallas and what he'll change from Dallas? I don't know if I'd say I necessarily have, first of all, thank you for the question. Second of all, I did watch a decent amount of Dallas this last year. There are a couple things I really would like to see, and a couple things that I have questions about. Number one, if Miles Turner is still on the roster, which by all accounts, it seems like he will be, I would really like to see him get utilized like Kristaps Porzingis was. I think you could argue Kristaps is a little bit better of a shooter, but I also think Miles did it. I mean, Miles has been a streakier shooter for sure. He's had really good years. He's had some meh years like last year, while having really good stretches in them. But I want to see Miles take 8 threes a game. I want to see Miles just absolutely jack from outside, because him taking shots without hesitancy is huge. And more importantly, I think getting him taking like 28 footers, stretching out, giving Karis, Malcolm, whoever's running pick and roll, an even bigger driving lane, like we saw for the Mavericks and Luka, like that can absolutely crush a defense in terms of what it does. If you can get the buy-in, or it's not even buy-in, but if you can just get Miles to comfortably be like, okay, I'm going to stop and pop every single shot that I'm asked out of this. If I'm running a double drag 5 feet above the line and I pop and take a three, then I'm not going to pause. Like there, and again, that's, I can't really judge that for sure, but that's something I would really like to see. I would like to see just more interesting bench lineups. Like, I think that's something that Rick's always been good at, finding really interesting ways to mix and match bench lineups and find ways for every single guy to get involved, which sounds simple, but like that was just something we didn't always see last year. It felt like there were a lot of guys who got utilized, but then also a couple who did not. So that's something that I want to see, and I expect to see from Rick, honestly. He's somebody who always gets the most out of his rosters. I'll talk more about the bench lineups in a minute. But in terms of expectations, I mean, I think part of the big allure with Rick coming over is the idea that we don't really... Well, I think what we know what to expect is that he's going to build something around the roster that makes sense. So that would be my expectation. Like, again, that's not to be reductive, but he builds what he's doing around the guys he has, which is part of what I really admire about him as a coach. And I think it's just extremely key to what this team is trying to do, considering they're more of a sum of their parts team. There isn't somebody like Luka who is going to be able to craft the number one overall offense around. Like, you have to find ways to really integrate everyone. And I think one of the things that I'm most interested to see this year is how the role hierarchy gets played out and how Rick decides to make some decisions with that, how he tempers the offense to meet the demands is the wrong way of putting it, but to filter through how to get the best out of everybody, maximizing everyone to the most that you can, because you can't maximize every single player if we're being completely realistic, but like, it's not about chalking things up to numbers, but like strictly like what does the usage look like for every single guy who is going to get a high level of touches? Like, that's something I'm very interested to see play out this year. And something I expect Rick to tinker with quite a bit. Like, I think last thing I'd say on it is just expecting a lot of tinkering. Like, that's what I want to see this year. There were times last year where even though the idea was that Nate Bjorken was going to be this guy who tested everything, it felt like at times he was really stuck in his ways and what he was doing. I think with Rick Carlisle, it's going to be different. I mean, we'll see how that goes throughout the year, but that would be my answer on that. So thank you for that question. Next from Mike, at Mike_Source. Assuming good health, how many games would it realistically take for the front office to come to conclusions regarding this Pacers team? Is it the same for both a positive and negative conclusion? That's a very good question. How would I answer this? I think the first way I would look at it in terms of how they view this team, like, I think it's already pretty clear that they think they're going to be at least pretty solid if they're fully healthy, which sounds reductive, but just given on reporting and the way that the front office, Chad Buchanan, Kevin Pritchard, Rick Carlisle have spoken, like, they know that they're talented and they've had really good flashes together when they're all healthy. So I think you can say 20 or 30 games in, they'll maybe have a pretty good feel and idea of where they are at as a team if they're healthy. Or maybe even if they're not healthy, they'll have a good idea. Because I think once you're 20 or 30 games in, you're getting close to the trade deadline, you have to be gauging, okay, where are we at as a team right now? What does this look like? I don't really know what to think about if the team is not doing well. Like, let's say the team is 530 or 30 games in or 35 games in. I do think that that raises some red flags. I think you very clearly have to be looking for a trade and looking to shake things up with the roster. So I think in some ways I would say, let's say the team gets off to a really good start. Like, let's say they're 15-5 over the first 20 games, which I don't think is super realistic, or maybe they're 14-8 over the first 22 or something. Like, that's a solid start. That probably puts you in the upper, you know, like, not being a play. You're not a playing team if you're that level. You're above the play and you're a guaranteed playoff team, which I think is what this team wants this year. I think you can have a pretty good idea about that 30 games in. I don't know why that's the number I chose, but I'm going to go with it. It's my gut instinct. I think that's when you have a fairly solid idea of what a team is like. But I guess I would say negatively too, like, if the team does start really, really poorly, like if the team is 8-14 or 15 or something, like, then you have a pretty solid idea of where you're at as a team. Like, even if things change up throughout the year, it's hard to make up an 8-game gap like that. Like, we've seen the Heat team that I think they went, gosh, I'm trying to remember what their record was, but they flipped their record like halfway through the year. Like, their first 41 games, I think they went like 15-26 or something like that. Then they went like 26-15 down the back end, and they still missed out on the playoffs. Like, it's just very hard to make those kinds of those deficits up. So again, I would say 30 to 35 games is where I think you're going to have an idea. But again, looking at it like last year, because that's what I thought it would be like last year, in talking about Victor, like, they found an opportunity 11 games into the year and ran with it. And I think I look for them to do the same thing this year, because I just don't have the impression that they are super confident in staying solid as they are right now. Like, I do think that they're very open to making moves and know that they need to make a move to hit a higher level of contention, which I do think that is the ultimate goal for them. Not necessarily that they're going to put themselves into title contention, because that's hard, but I do think that they're going to put themselves in as much of a position as possible to be a second round plus team, and seeing what can go from there. So hopefully that answers your question.
Today's episode is brought to you by Cars.com. With over 2 million vehicles and 50,000 more added every day, Cars.com will match you with the perfect car for you, your budget, your life, your style. And if you're ready to say goodbye to your current car, Cars.com will get you an instant offer to cash it in. Just start by entering your license plate and get matched with a local dealer who will write you the check. So whether you're looking to buy or sell, just go to Cars.com. It's magical.
To my next question from Derek Kramer over at iPacers blog, should the Pacers pursue a Lance Stephenson reunion? Should I pursue blocking you, Derek, is the real question. No, just kidding. I really brought that on myself by tweeting about Lance the other day. I think in some ways, like, just answering this positively for all of my misgivings that I tend to have about Lance Stephenson, which is less about on-court, more about, you know, some other stuff. I think that, it, like, sure, I mean, he's pretty old now. He hasn't played in the NBA in 2 years, not since the 18-19 season with the Lakers. I mean, maybe. I don't think it's necessarily bad. It's not like it's amazing either. Like, I think if you really view him as a vital part of the locker room and being somebody who can bring guys up or and be a veteran mentor for younger guys, then I would understand it. But I also think I would just rather give that opportunity to a younger player who you think could thrive in a lesser rotation spot, or maybe there is somebody who comes up later on in the season that the Pacers could pursue with the MLE. Like, maybe the guy, somebody gets bought out or something, and Indy can offer him, offer that guy like their MLE. I don't know. That was not the greatest example of all time, but that's my long story short of saying I am not really super into the idea of signing Lance Stephenson, but I think it could be understood for the most part. So thank you for the question from Thomas Welch at WelchT21. What bench units would you like to see together with the Doug Sabonis core being broken up? I've always loved Justin and Miles on the court together, but how would you like bench units to go this year? I love this question. It's something I've thought about a lot, and I'm not entirely sure how to view it in some ways. Like, there are a lot of lineups I would like to see. One would be running with, you know, Brogdon, LeVert, TJ Warren, O'Shea Brissett, and Miles Turner. I know that's not necessarily a bench unit, but just getting out as much length and perimeter ability as possible. Like, I think, not to say that Sabonis doesn't have that, but that's just an interesting lineup. I mean, this is not meant as like a anti-Sabonis thing or like pro-Miles thing. This is more just like, I think that would be really interesting. I am very excited about what O'Shea is going to do this year. He looked incredible at Summer League. He obviously looked incredible last year. A lot is going to hinge on what the shot is like for him this year and whether or not it upholds to what he did last year. So there are obviously questions there. I mean, going off of that too, I would say, all right, well, let's see, what does it look like with Ed at the one, Malcolm at the two, TJ, O'Shea, and Miles. You get a ton of athleticism with that, a lot of length. I mean, it's not like a pro anyone, anti anyone, but like, that's just a really intriguing lineup to me. I really want to see Ed get the ball in his hands more this year, or at least in transition opportunities, maybe some pick and roll opportunities too. I don't know how much he's going to get of that, but it's something I would very much like to see because he showed real flashes with it last year as his confidence really grew. And he's just, I think that getting the most out of Ed and O'Shea is going to be huge for the team this year. That's a group I would like to see. I also, any lineup that has Domantas Sabonis, TJ McConnell, and Chris Duarte is going to be must-watch basketball for me. I'm tripping up all over my words today. I'm so excited for Duarte playing off of Sabonis. Like, Duarte's, probably the best off-ball mover on the team now, other than TJ Warren. I mean, TJ's a god at moving off-ball for the most part. Like, I think adding Chris Duarte as a guy who can play off the gravity of Domas, be awesome coming off screens, do a lot of stuff as a cutter, maybe run some second side. Not maybe. Like, I think he will run some second side actions. I'm so excited to see what he looks like playing with Domas. I'm also excited for more, let's see some more Goga Domas or Goga Miles minutes, because they have to happen. Like, they have to happen. They have to. This team has the optionality to play small and big at the same time, or not at the same time, but in the same game. Like, they have the ability to throw a lot of looks out using all 13 guys on their bench. Not that you're going to use all 13 guys in a game, but you get my point. Like, you have ways. Okay, what if we want to throw out a lineup that's like Sumner, Brogdon, LeVert, TJ Warren, and Torrey Craig or something? Like, I don't think it's great, but like, that, because I do think you have to have a five out there. But let's just say they do that, and they're saying, okay, Torrey Craig's going to play the five for 2 minutes, which, again, I don't think is great, but you can look at that and say, okay, well, we have the possibilities to do that. If it looks really good, we can make teams play and cater to what we're doing. Or we can throw out Domas and Goga, or Domas and Miles, and really try and force teams to play bigger or have to adapt to playing with size. So again, it's not, there's nothing that's necessarily perfect about the roster, but if things do really work and Rick Carlisle is able to make things gel, I do think that there are a lot of ways in which it makes sense to say that this team has a lot of versatility. But again, a lot of that depends on what is O'Shea's shot like? How is TJ? Because I think TJ Warren and O'Shea Brissett are the two guys who really open up the most for this roster as kind of connectors, positionality, positionally. Jeez, I'm again tripping all over my words. I think the last bench unit I want to hit on, like you mentioned, Miles and Justin, but Justin actually getting to play the three. So Miles, Justin, and O'Shea, and whatever ball handler and like Torrey Craig is a really interesting lineup. I don't know how much Torrey Craig is going to play this year. That's something I'm really interested to track. Like, I don't think that he signed to just play no minutes, but also I don't think he's a guy who has like a ton of say in saying, well, I want to play 25 minutes per game or something like that. Also, that's just not really available for him. But, you know, we saw really viable bench lineups with Miles this year. We've also seen viable bench lineups with Domas. But the Justin Miles lineups were really fun to watch last year. And I do think that there's a lot of interesting stuff that could happen in terms of playing around with the wings and ball handlers on that bench unit as well. So I appreciate the question, Thomas. Hopefully that was a solid answer. From Larry Golden at underscore Laro Hoops, there's a question about the Chicago Sky. Chicago Sky seem to have a problem when Candace or Courtney are off the floor, and that's Candace Parker or Courtney Vandersloot. What would you like to see this guy do in the offseason to fix this, or is it simply Diamond and others have to take a step? Such a good question. I'm so torn on the Chicago Sky, man. I don't really know what to take from them. They just dropped an absolutely brutal loss to the Mercury last night, who have been red hot. They have not lost a game since the Olympic break. I think it's less about the issues that I have when Courtney and Candace are off the court, more like I think they need to be even better when they're on the court together. I don't think that they do enough to get Candace going on offense, to be frank. Like, I think that they kind of underutilize her in some ways. Like, I get how awesome of a passer she is, especially for someone her size, with her intersection of athleticism, handle, and size. But also, like, okay, use her going towards the rim. Like, you can't just always have her playmaking from the top of the arc, which is what it feels like so often. Run some DHOs with her and Allie Quigley. Run her as a role man, a role woman, I should say. Just get her more involved going towards the rim, because she's so dynamic as a player inside the arc. And I get it, she can shoot too. Like, just mix things up. Actually, try and run more stuff with her. They do it occasionally, but not enough for my liking. Obviously, Courtney Vandersloot is incredible. That roster is so good. They do need Diamond to Shields to be even better in some way. She had a really good game last night until she got injured. I hope she's okay. I think she will be. It looked like just an ankle tweak. That would be my main answer to that, because this isn't really a team that can wait for roster turnover. Like, they're pretty old. Allie Quigley's 35. I think Courtney Vandersloot's right around there. Candace Parker's in her mid-30s. Like, Diamond is pretty young. Kalia Copper is young as well. But also, I just don't think when you're three of your five best players are in their mid to late 30s, you can't really wait around for roster turnover. Like, this is a big year for this guy. They have to make the most of it. I'm still waiting for them to put everything together for a late season push. They needed that game last night against Phoenix, but it was not in the cards for them. And they still have a brutal schedule down the stretch. They play the Storm in a back-to-back pretty soon. Oh, I know. They just played the Storm in a back-to-back. I'm totally mixing that up. But they are playing a really tough schedule down the stretch as well. Second part of your question. Pacers are interesting. What would be a successful season in your eyes? I talked about it a little bit in Alex's question earlier. In terms of regular season, like, I think being a top six seed is ideal for them. Well, not just ideal, like, they need to be that, in my opinion, for it to be a successful season. But a successful season for the Pacers, for me, is, I mean, they need to make it to the second round of the playoffs. I don't know if they get out of there. It's going to be a lot more of kind of waiting to see, because this team has so much variability. Like, I think every team in the NBA does to an extent, but to me, this Pacers team has more questions and unknowns to me than most any team in the NBA, which I'll talk about on a future pod. But There are just so many questions about what could happen with this. For it to be a successful season, I do think it has to be second round of the playoffs and being competitive there, not just getting run off the court. So thank you for the question. Next question from Jeff Hasser at Jefferson Hasser on Twitter. If you could time travel and bring any player from Pacer history onto the roster, who would fit the best and why? I'm assuming it would be a former All-Star, but also curious of non-All-Star level guys. I mean, the two obvious ones right away are Paul George and Reggie Miller. And then, I mean, you could add Danny Granger on top of that. I actually think in some ways Danny and Paul make the most sense for the roster, needing more of a forward than a wing. Like, obviously you need a wing, don't get me wrong. But, like, I think having somebody who's a 3 or a 3-4 could play the 4 sometimes. We don't talk about Paul at the 4 here. Danny Granger would be fantastic. He's somebody who could hang on defense. Like, I do think he'd be better defensively on a better team. Be a knockdown 3-point shooter, self-create a little bit, quality enough as a passer. Like, he would make a lot of sense on the team. Obviously, Paul is the guy. Paul's, in my opinion, probably the best. Well, I can't necessarily unleash the Paul George best pacer of all time take, but I do think Paul at his peak was probably the best pacer of all time. In his time with Indiana, no. Like, Reggie is the best pacer who played in Indiana. Paul's career, you know, almost becoming an MVP. Like, I do think in some ways that's a little bit more than Reggie did. Or not more than he did, but at his peak, I do think Paul was a better on-ball player than Reggie. Quibbling over who's ranked where is, that's not really something I care about. I think Reggie's, I guess, whatever you want to say, is the better all-time player in some ways, but I do think Paul could surpass him. I don't really care about that. That's my answer to that. In terms of, like, guys who are less stars, like, Vern Fleming would be really interesting on this team, and I know that's a poll, but, like, just a big ball handler who was a good playmaker, could get to the inside. I wonder what his shot looks like now. He wasn't really a shooter when he was playing in the late 80s, early 90s, but he was a good free throw shooter. So, like, I think that's there for him. Like, I do think the team needs more drivers, playmakers. I love the idea of adding somebody like Derek McKee to this team, who I still don't think it really solves anything for you, but that does something fun, especially if you're looking at non-All-Star guys, like a wing who theoretically can knock down shots. He was really only a good shooter in the years when the three-point line was shortened, but I do think it would be different now. Who else, man? Like, Chuck Person obviously would be fantastic on this team, but he would be really, really darn good on any team as a versatile forward who could shoot and handle a little bit. I'm trying to think of one more good one to pull. This is a really good question. I do appreciate historical questions. I think here's my answer. I would go with Al Harrington. Al Harrington would be my final answer in terms of doing a realistic one. Because he's somebody who I think would be he was more of a tweener in his days and that when it wasn't really necessarily positive to be. He was a little small to play the four most of his career, especially during his prime. Like, I think he would be a fantastic four now who could play small ball five a little bit. Maybe in bigger lineups you could ask him to play the three. He could pass. I don't know if I'd say he's a great passer or anything, but he's somebody who could dribble, pass, and shoot and play defense, at least at an average level. And that matters when you're 6'9". So I think Al Harrington would be a great fit on this team because this team really misses guys like that. Like, they need more of that lineup versatility, like we've talked about. I think that would make a lot of sense for them. So thank you for that question. Hopefully, I'd like to hear what you think. Let me know in the comments on Twitter and what anybody else thinks as well. I'd love to hear. There are a lot of great ways you can go with that one. Maybe there are some ABA guys who would make sense too. From Elliot Beaver at Beaver Elliot. Is Warren better suited at the 3 or 4, and will Sabonis ever end before Turner's contract is up in 2 years? To the second part of the question, I think so, just being completely honest. Like, I do think that Sabonis will be over, quote unquote, before Turner's contract is up in 2 years. And is TJ Warren better suited at the 3 or the 4? I think part of what's really interesting about TJ is that it doesn't really matter. Like, TJ Warren brings you good defense at the point of attack. He brings you good size. He can shoot from all three levels and score at all three levels, I should say. Of course, he can shoot from 3 feet away. He can finish at the rim. He's a good finisher at the rim. He can finish inside the arc. And he's capable of shooting from three. Obviously, he's working on as a passer. So I think in some ways he's a little bit more suited to be the four, but he can play both depending on who he's playing next to. Like we've talked about, I think that's been a theme on a lot of my pods. Just part of the reason TJ was missed so much last year is because of the versatility that he brings by being able to slot in multiple spots and do multiple things for you. Like, even if he's relatively average at some things, like particularly on defense, like that's okay. Being 6 foot eight and average at defense is really important in the NBA. I would argue that it's almost more important than being a good guard defender or something like that. Like, there are things you can look at and say, well, it's better to be average and be big than to be small and like really good at something. And maybe that's a very reductive way of putting it. I don't think I would necessarily ascribe that to everything, but like, we saw so much of how much that was missed last year. As good as Justin Holiday is defensively, he was overtaxed. As good as some of these guys are offensively, like we saw, like Edmund Sumner couldn't play the four. That's asking way too much. Even if you could make some argument that he's a better defender than TJ Warren, I don't know if I'd make that argument. It's just off the top of my head. Having TJ Warren be 6 foot eight with a plus wingspan and being okay at defense or good at defense, however you want to call it, like that matters. So I think that's how I'd say, he's kind of a 3.5 to me. There are moments where he can play both. So it's not a perfect answer, but that's how I would go with it. Three more questions. One from over at Motor City Hoops. And also, thank you, Elliot. I appreciate the question. Thanks for always engaging with my stuff. From at Motor City Hoops, as an outsider, I look at the roster and see a lot of talent, but can't help but wonder if there's a number one option on a championship team. Do you think there is? If not, how do you see them going about getting one? First of all, if you guys don't follow at Motor City Hoops, you should. Bryce is great. His podcast is fantastic. Great way to keep up with the Pistons. Also a really great guy too. So keep up with his stuff. No, there is not a number one championship guy and a number one option on a championship team guy, but I also think it's a little bit arbitrary, and I don't mean that as a slight at your question. I just, whatever. There are like four guys in the NBA who are number one options on a championship team, so I don't really care. How do you see them going about getting one? I don't personally think they're going to get one, but I do think in terms of looking at a number one option on a really good team, like I really do believe in a Domantas Sabonis leap happening as a scorer. It's something I want to write about. I've been thinking about it a decent bit because I do think there's a real leap in him as a scorer. Somebody who can get to the free throw line a little bit more, that would really change how I see him as a scorer, and I think it would change how teams guard him as well. I also would say that I think that there is a chance for a TJ Warren leap this year as an offensive player, maybe more as a playmaker, more as somebody who can handle the ball, who can run some offense, like we started to see in the bubble. That's more of a, I'm less certain of that because he obviously missed a really big opportunity to develop that last year, which sucked for him and for the team, of course, but more for him. Because personally, on a personal level, like him having to sit out a whole year, that sucks as a person. So yeah, that's how I look at it. It's more looking at, okay, if this team makes the conference finals, can TJ Warren be your best player? Or your quote unquote number one option? Can Domas be like, I think there are avenues where you could see that and say, maybe. I don't have a super concrete answer, but again, this team is more based on like being extremely good 1 through 6 or 7 and having good players up and down the roster than necessarily having one guy who fits all. We talked more about Ben Simmons earlier in the pod, who, again, he's not a number one option, but top-end talent is important. From Brian Hardwick at Red Voodoo 1013 on Twitter, realistically, what superstar would you like to see the Pacers trade for? I don't really think there's a superstar that's available. We talked about Ben Simmons earlier. I don't really know who else is going to become available. Again, I don't really think the Pacers are in the real opportunity to trade for Dame Lillard. I don't really know who else is going to be available anytime soon. So again, I'm not trying to cop out, but I think I would default to Ben Simmons right now. So I appreciate the question. And lastly, geez, I am really tripping up a lot today. Lastly, from Tristan Duncan at T Dunk, and for Dunk, it's D-U-N-C-C-C. How did you end up covering the Pacers? Also, can you describe the Summer League experience as a whole? Love the content, Mark. Keep up the great work. First of all, thank you a ton, man. I appreciate the kind words. I ended up covering the Pacers because Tom Lewis is awesome, and I emailed him one day asking if they needed any help at any cornrows. Somehow Tom had come across my work before, and he was interested in bringing me on, and I was just fortunate enough to start from there after, you know, just kind of doing my own thing as a blogger and podcaster for a little bit. I was lucky enough to get that opportunity, and I like to think that I've done pretty well with it. Well, still trying to do even better. Can you describe the Summer League experience as a whole? Summer League is kind of wild because it's the only time other than All-Star break, and even, I mean, All-Star break isn't even necessarily the same, but it's the only time where all 30 teams, people who cover them, people who work for them, come together. So, like, for example, like, you walk out to Thomas and Mack Center one day, and the first people you see outside the arena are Caron Butler and Mike Bibby, like, stuff like that. Like, walking through and seeing, man, who all was there? Like, I mean, obviously LeBron came through one day. The Ball brothers were there. I walked past Jaden and Jalen McDaniels one time in the arena, which was kind of wild. Like, you're there and you see all these people who you know from talking to or, you know, obviously covering. Like, it's just kind of awesome to be there in person and finally get to see everyone and not be just like, you know, talking to somebody in DMs or texting. Like, I think that was the coolest part about it for me. Obviously, the basketball was fun. Getting to watch, like, double-digit games in a small course of days in person was fantastic after not seeing an in-person game for, like, 2 years. So I loved that. I loved the experience. The food was expensive as hell. The entire city is crazy expensive and a very overwhelming place, just to be completely honest. Like, there's ads everywhere. My Uber from the hotel to the airport was $35, and it's an 8-minute ride. So, like, you know, planning more for that next year is going to be interesting and important for me. But overall, I just thought the experience was great, man. Like, getting to get out and just kind of do human stuff. Obviously, I was, you know, you have your mask on the entire time, which is still something odd to get used to. It's odd being in crowds again in some ways, but yeah, man, it was awesome. And I'm just really fortunate that I was able to do it, and I appreciate you and just anyone in general who supports me and says kind of things about my work, because I don't always feel the best about it. So I appreciate when people build me up like that, and it makes me feel pretty good about what I'm doing. So thank you again for the kind words, man. And just thank you to everyone. I appreciate you all listening. I'm really excited for the season to get started and cover things, try and do an even better job than we did last year. Obviously, we have a lot to break down. It's going to be hopefully a more eventful. I don't want to say eventful. A more exciting season in terms of wins, having, you know, real viability as a team compared to last year. Because last year was really frustrating, as we know. Like, just analyzing it was frustrating. Talking about all the stuff off court was frustrating. I'm very excited for what this team could mean for you guys as fans this year. And I really hope to provide the best analysis and insight possible, because that's what I want to do. So I know this is a little bit shorter of a mailbag episode. I mean, for me, it went 47 minutes, but I appreciate you all listening. I hope you're all having a great day. Great end of summer. It's not end of summer to me. I know fall technically started, but end of summer is when it is in the 60s or 50s to me, not when it's still 75 outside. So we're getting there. But thank you again for sending any questions in. If you have any questions, comments, whatever, feel free to send them to me. My DMs are open on Twitter. You can email me as well. It's in my bio on Twitter. I hope you're all having a great day. Thank you again for listening, and go Pacers.